Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Free Speech and Election Law Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, April 8, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today, we're going to be talking about the McCutcheon case, the campaign finance reform case recently decided by the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call, and we're recording today's call for use as a podcast in the future. As I mentioned, we're going to hear from one expert today with the customary brief introduction so we can turn to the substance as soon as possible. He's going to make opening remarks of about 10 to 15 minutes, after which we'll take questions from the audience, so please be thinking about your questions. Our expert today is Professor Bradley A. Smith. He's got some great titles here. He is the 2013-2014 Judge John T. Copenhaver Visiting Endowed Chair of Law at the West Virginia University College of Law. He's also the Josiah H. Blackmore II Shirley M. Nault Designated Professor of Law at Capital University Law School. And finally, he is the former chairman of the Federal Elections Commission. He's going to get us started with his opening remarks. Professor Smith, please go right ahead.
All right. Well, thanks, Dean. Yeah, we're going to talk about McCutcheon today, and is this really the new Citizens United or the next Citizens United? Does this really destroy campaign finance law, as has been suggested? Just by way of background, very briefly, the Federal Election Campaign Act has, since 1974, included an aggregate cap on how much an individual can give to party committees or to candidates. So an individual donor can give up to what is currently $2,600 per election to a candidate. Since that includes both the primary and a general, that would be $5,200 in an election cycle. The individual can give up to $30,400 to a political party, but the individual is also limited to a total of $48,600 going to all candidates, or to $74,600 going to all political parties. The end result of this was called the aggregate cap. The end result of this was that a person such as Sean McCutcheon, who is a well-to-do but not what you'd think of as an oligarch or a Forbes 400 type person by any means, Sean McCutcheon could give the maximum legal contribution to 8 candidates for office. But if he wanted to give that maximum to a 9th candidate, he would find himself limited, and to a 10th candidate prohibited from making any further contributions. The sense was that this makes no sense at all. The candidate, the 9th or 10th candidate, is not corrupted if candidates 1 to 8 are not corrupted. And this was the common sense charge that McCutcheon put before the court. He was eventually joined as a plaintiff in this action by the Republican National Committee, which made a similar argument about the aggregate caps on giving to parties. If the Republican National Committee is not going to be a source of corruption for taking a maximum contribution, and the Republican Senatorial Committee is not, and McCutcheon's state party would not be corrupted by a maximum contribution there, which is a bit lower limit, and his local party would not, why would it be that the aggregate of doing this would somehow corrupt those parties and lead to corruption of the system? So that was the basic issue placed before the court. The majority is a 5-4 decision suggesting that, holding that the laws, that the aggregate caps are unconstitutional. It's worth noting that the opinion by Chief Justice Roberts is only a plurality opinion because Justice Thomas refused to join that opinion. Justice Thomas simply concurred in the judgment and made clear his view that he would essentially overturn pretty much all campaign finance laws, including the individual contribution limits on giving to a particular candidate or party. So it's a four-person opinion with Thomas concurring in the judgment. Now, the dissent, which consists of Justice Breyer writing for the court's four liberals, argues that this is going to be a great source of corruption. They place much of their argument in a series of hypotheticals arguing that a candidate could now write, or I'm sorry, not a candidate, but a donor could write a single check for several million dollars to a joint fundraising committee. A joint fundraising committee is simply a way by which candidates and parties often get together and raise money at a single event. This is fairly common. For example, we see it at presidential races where an event will be held in which the first $2,600 will go to the presidential candidate, and then another $30,000 will go to the national political party, and that's a joint fundraising event. The donor writes a single check, and the two committees, the presidential committee and the party committee, divvy that up. Under the hypotheticals that the dissent used, a donor might conceivably give the legal maximum to each of the party's three national committees. That would be the Democratic or Republican National Committee, the Democratic or Republican Senatorial, and then Congressional Committee, plus the maximum to all 50 state committees, plus to perhaps local committees or to PACs, or in some scenarios, he would have a joint fundraising committee for all 435 congressional candidates of a party to shower them each with $2,600 contributions. I think these are not plausible, although they are theoretically possible hypotheticals. They're really not plausible, and I think for a number of reasons. First, we have never seen those at the federal level. For example, I don't think that there has ever been, under the prior limits, a joint fundraising committee that raised the total legal maximum, which would have been about $122,000. At any time. We also note that the overwhelming majority of states that have contribution limits, and not every state has them, but the overwhelming majority of states that do have them, do not have an aggregate limit of any kind, and we've not seen this problem appear there. In fact, common sense tells us that it's unlikely to occur. Most donors don't want to give to all 435 of a party's candidates. They don't want to give to a bunch of state parties. As a practical matter, it needs to be understood that a joint fundraising committee doesn't allow an individual to give a check to John Boehner, who is then just going to divvy it up among his party's members. That's the scene we keep hearing, at least not divvy it up by any choice of his. Rather, each candidate would be predetermined the amount that they would get, typically in this scare hypothetical, the maximum $2,600, and that would be given over to those candidates, and the donor could give no more to those candidates. He would have maxed out, as the term goes. So I think those hypotheticals are very unlikely. Now, what is the impact of the decision? Well, I think that contrary to what some have suggested, the immediate impact will not be that great. Certainly, it opens new avenues for fundraising. It allows large donors to give to more candidates and to give to more party committees. And that makes them targets. It will allow for more joint fundraising committees. There will be some added activity of joint fundraising committees. But if we think about it, one thing the government made much of in this case was that the aggregate limits only affected a few hundred people, and therefore the argument was that this was not an important First Amendment interest, sort of as if we decided that we shouldn't bother about worrying about Miranda rights anymore because that only affected a small number of criminals. So, you know, who really cares? Or, you know, we shouldn't really worry about a law that would just prohibit, a small number of people from exercising their Second Amendment rights. But in any case, that was the argument. And there is some truth to that. It doesn't affect a lot of people. That also minimizes the impact of the decision. If we were to assume that, say, 300 of these 700 or 800 people or so were to actually contribute an additional $1 million in political contributions, that is money that they don't already give to independent expenditure committees or something like that, we'd be talking about $300 million more into the system. That sounds like a lot to the untrained ear in raw dollars. Of course, we will spend in 2016 probably about $10 billion on politics regardless of this decision. So you're really talking about, you know, maybe something in the realm of, you know, 2 to 5 or 6% of new money would come into the system, hardly, I think, blowing the system away. Therefore, the real importance of the decision in my mind comes more in the tenor of the opinion and the tone of the opinion and what it might promise for future rulings. Here, this is a very strong opinion by the Chief Justice. It's important, I think, that the Chief Justice himself chose to write the opinion. He begins by addressing the standard of review. For a long time, the court has had different standards of review, a tougher standard of review, strict scrutiny for expenditure limits, but only exacting scrutiny for contribution limits. And sometimes this exacting scrutiny has been perceived to be very little, most notably in the 2000 decision, Nixon versus Shrink Missouri Government PAC. Here, Justice Roberts definitely tries to give some teeth to the standard of exacting scrutiny. He describes it as rigorous, as closely drawn, that there must be a close fit between the stated governmental objective and the means selected to achieve that objective. And he rejects the idea that you can keep piling prophylaxis on prophylaxis, noting that even the limit on giving to a candidate, the $2,600 limit, is a prophylaxis since most contributions are not intended to and are not corrupting. In that respect, he suggests that it's going to be much harder to get future limits past the Supreme Court, even under the exacting scrutiny clause. I think that's a correct interpretation of exacting scrutiny as it was originally described in Buckley, but it's important that he's put that marker down there and will make it harder for future legislative efforts to withstand that exacting scrutiny. He also makes clear that corruption is a term of art limited to quid pro quo type exchanges. That is, exchanges that would look like or have the appearance of bribery, and that any appearance of corruption also has to go to the appearance that that type of bribery exchange is taking place, a direct quid pro quo. He strongly rejects the notion that merely gaining access to a politician is corruption, or the fact that a politician might be grateful to those who have supported him is a form of corruption, and specifically rejects other types of interests that the government might raise, such as leveling the playing field or attempting to equalize the financial resources of candidates. So the decision suggests that in the future it's going to be very hard for campaign finance laws to stand up to the court's decision-making or to the court's scrutiny. I think it's a good summary of the opinion is actually found in the way the Chief Justice opens the opinion. He opens the opinion by noting that there is no right more basic in our democracy than the right to participate in electing our political leaders. And then after a brief paragraph or two, he adds, those who govern should be the last people to help decide who should govern. That's a very strong statement of skepticism about the self-interested motivation and opportunity for self-dealing that legislators have when they go into the realm of campaign finance. And I think that suggests a very skeptical court the next time a campaign finance regulation comes before the court. So we're ready to take questions, Dean, if you want to open the floor, or I'll let you take over.
Well, thank you very much, Professor. In a moment, we're all going to hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for our expert, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. While we're waiting to see who rings in, let me ask you, I have two questions really for you, Professor. One, is this court now likely to overturn other or even all contribution limits? And then secondly, do you want to say a few words about the dissent? Was there one dissent or some combination, and what were their main points, if you could say a few words about that?
Sure. Let's address that first question first, which is the issue of is the court now going to strike down all contribution limits? I don't think the court has pledged itself to that at all. Certainly, again, it has suggested that new regulations are going to have a tough time, but the basic dichotomy the court has held to since Buckley v. Valeo in 1976 is that contribution limits are acceptable, they pass constitutional muster, expenditure limits are not. The court, although it was skeptical, did not pledge itself in any way to change that definition or that dichotomy at all. And in fact, it has just turned down a petition for cert from Iowa Right to Life, which was arguing that contribution limits on corporate donations in that state were unconstitutional. Iowa, interestingly enough, allows unions to contribute directly to campaigns, but not corporations. So there was both a speech, direct speech element, and an equal protection element to that challenge. The court just denied cert on that. I don't know that the court has a real appetite for totally overturning the limits on what one can give to a particular candidate. But again, some limits may be subject to greater scrutiny. We can think of both things on the margin, such as the current limitation that prohibits a spouse from giving more than $2,600 to his or her spouse. That would be something that might be deemed as not having an anti-corruption purpose at all. And there might be other little things like that on the edge. There might be some room to push contribution limits higher to say that some state limits are simply too low to allow for adequate speech. On the dissent side, there is one principal dissent, one dissent by Justice Breyer, again representing the court's four liberals. And this is a very important dissent, actually. And in my mind, frankly, it's a very scary dissent. On four different occasions, Justice Breyer suggests that the collective speech interest, and that's the term he uses, the collective speech interest should override the individual interest of donors. He even cites for this Rousseau, who of course, I'm not suggesting that Justice Breyer is totalitarian, but Rousseau is sort of the patron saint of totalitarian regimes for the last 200 years. It seems like an odd choice of a citation to cite Rousseau for this, what he calls the collective will, rather than the general will, which is Rousseau's term. But Breyer suggests that this is sufficient to override individual speech rights. And really, that turns the First Amendment on its head. I mean, the First Amendment has always been viewed as an individual right to speak as protection from the government or from the majority attempting to silence you. Breyer now says, no, essentially the speaker has to prove that his speech has some type of social value to it and that it doesn't offend the norms of the majority. And only if he can do that does his speech go forward. It is, in my mind, a very dangerous dissent. Floyd Abrams, among some other folks normally on the political left, have assailed the dissent for exactly those purposes. And to me, the fact that four justices have signed on to it is a very worrisome sign, and all of us should be concerned about what that says for the future of free speech as an individual right. You know, again, I don't mean for this kind of rhetoric to make it sound like I think Justice Breyer's a totalitarian. He's my former professor. I don't think that about him at all. But it's that kind of muddled thinking that has always led to tyranny in the past. You know, if we go back to the Cold War, you know, the Soviets and all the other communist countries had wonderful free speech clauses in their constitution, and you could say just about anything you wanted as long as it didn't offend the collective will. And I really fear that that type of thinking is just very dangerous. I also think it's kind of odd as a constitutional matter. Breyer has said in his book Act of Liberty, and he's expounded on it in a couple of his concurring opinions in the past, that there shouldn't be a presumption against regulation of political speech because some of these rules may enhance First Amendment values. For example, if we limit the speech of some, it may make others more powerful, and that may enhance First Amendment values. My feeling has always been that the First Amendment says Congress shall make no law. And while we can debate whether no law is really intended to be read liberally and how much room it leaves for the government maybe to regulate, it strikes me that at a minimum, Congress shall make no law should mean that there is a presumption against government regulation of speech. And so when Breyer says there's no room for a presumption against government regulation of speech, I think he's really got things backwards and in a way that is pretty much indefensible. But for now, at least, that opinion remains a minority opinion on the court, and I think we can be grateful for that.
Well, we've got quite a few people on the line, five people indicating they have questions. If you want to add yourself to the queue, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got lots of time left. So let's go to our first caller.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. It seems that we have a need to push legal arguments toward bringing out the real motivations of the proponents of campaign finance reform, as they like to call it. They're addressing a real problem, which is the public choice problem, the undue influence that the wealthy and the powerful may have over public policy without necessarily them even donating money to those who they would influence, but merely by having a reputation as a large donor, as a large player. So all of these reform efforts are really a way of trying to nip at the edges of this problem of undue influence by a few who are especially affected by policy decisions. And it seems that one of the avenues that need to be taken in legal argument is to point out that the choices that people make in election campaigns are not just of the candidates, but of the kind of messages that they will choose to listen to. And if the people choose to listen to the kind of messages that money will buy, that is their choice just as much as their choice to decide on the candidate. And that if people want to do something about that, they need to educate people to ignore messages of that kind.
One thing I've always emphasized is that concerns about money in politics, the public choice concerns, as John calls them, are certainly real. There are certainly concerns about self-dealing and, you know, now people like to use the term crony capitalism and so on. I think that there are a number of points to make. First is that if we talk about large special interests, particularly large corporate interests, they typically spend many, many times on lobbying what they spend on campaign finance. And there's just very little real evidence that campaign contributions are dramatically shaping the debate. They may shape or help to shape who's elected, but not much evidence that they change the votes or priorities of those who are in office. The other point ultimately is that we had a constitutional system that was largely designed to check special interests. We had, if we look at doctrines such as federalism, separation of powers, bicameralism, enumerated powers, all of those were intended to check the ability of special interests to take over the government and use it, exploit the rest of the citizens to their gain. Unfortunately, we've eroded all of those different checks. In fact, many of the people who are most enamored of campaign finance reform are those who have been most active in attempting to erode those checks because they want a big, powerful government. Having achieved a big, powerful government, they've discovered that one of the potential costs is a fair amount of rent seeking going on. And their answer to that is, well, now let's restrict the political freedom of the people. But ultimately, it is simply very dangerous to do that. All of the data shows that low spending campaigns benefit incumbents. There's reason to believe, and I think again the data shows, that new ideas and political outsiders are most likely to benefit from large spenders, whether it's large contributions directly to candidates or whether it's large independent expenditures. So ultimately, these efforts to limit campaign finance tend to shut the system down, to lead to greater sclerosis and less diversity of ideas, more difficulty in getting new ideas to the fore, greater difficulty in shaking up the status quo. I sometimes put it out, I'll just note that, you know, we don't have much to show for 40 years now of attempting to regulate heavily in this area. And this is a classic case here. Prior to 1974, again, there were never in American history limits on what an individual could give to a federal candidate. So I think that we have to look and say, have we really accomplished much in the last 40 years? Or maybe it's time to go back to this idea of, you know, Congress shall make no law, that the purpose of the First Amendment is to leave political speech deregulated and competitive, and that the problem of rent seeking is best addressed through other constitutional norms, norms which unfortunately, in my view, have also been eroded over time.
We've got two callers with questions pending now. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another call.
Hey, Brad. This is Doug Chalmers calling from the Political Law Group. Hope you're doing well. My question to you concerns the contribution limits on, or the ban on, corporations making contribution limits to federal candidates. Now, it seems to me that after Citizens United, if the only justification for an imposition on First Amendment limits is preventing quid pro quo corruption or the appearance of it, and if Congress has determined that contributions up to the contribution limit do not present a risk of that corruption, why the ban on corporations giving contributions to federal candidates should continue to remain valid? And I'm curious for your thoughts on that.
Well, I, I think that's an excellent point. One thing that's always interested me is that corporations can operate political action committees, and political action committees are able to solicit the corporate shareholders, managers, and executives and their families for contributions, which they then can make to candidates. They can't spend general corporate funds on it, but they can get these voluntary contributions and contribute those through the corporate PAC. Now, if we think about that, that means large corporations can have fairly large PACs. They have a large number of people they can solicit, and it pays for them to operate a PAC. Small corporations cannot do that. Small corporations find it doesn't pay to operate a PAC. The administrative cost, the compliance cost, can be quite significant. And if you have a small corporation, say a company that employs 45 or 60 or 100 people, the number of people you have who can actually contribute to the PAC is quite small. And so the contribution or the compliance cost will eat up pretty much everything that actually would go into the PAC. The end result is that small corporations are not able to make contributions, whereas large corporations can use a PAC to make what appear to be corporate contributions to candidates for office subject to limits. So it strikes me that simply doing away with the intermediate PAC step would probably be a step in the right direction for those who are concerned about smaller donors and small business versus big business. The difficulty would simply come in the proliferation of corporations, establishing various subsidiaries and so on. You can police that through affiliation rules, which deem that any one corporation that owns a majority of another, they're considered, you know, to have one limit. But that is fairly tough to do. So that would be the administrative challenge there. But I do agree and have suggested that the complete ban on corporate contributions probably doesn't make much sense. There's little reason to believe that a candidate is going to be more corrupted by getting $2,500 from the XYZ corporation than he is from getting $2,500 from the CEO of the XYZ corporation. As I noted, the court just turned down this case involving Iowa Right to Life, which was a nonprofit corporation of all things. That might be bad news for those who think, as you do, Doug, that we should overrule the ban on corporate contributions. I think it's important to note the Supreme Court has not really ruled specifically on a ban on corporate contributions, certainly not since it decided Citizens United. So I do think that their, you know, their thinking may just be to let this percolate a little bit more in the lower courts. I fear that the lower courts seem to think that they have to uphold a ban on corporate spending, corporate contributions at least, following Supreme Court precedent. But I don't think that's really there. And I think it would be good to see a couple other cases come up, see what the lower courts do with them, if some the Court of Appeals perhaps reaches a different decision, then that question might be ripe and the court might take it up.
Are there cases imminently in the pipeline for the court at this point on any of those points?
There are not that I'm aware of on the corporate contributions, but that's not to say that they aren't there. They just aren't there that I'm aware of.
Right. Okay, we have one question pending, and then our lines will be open. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone if you'd like to join the conversation. But for now, let's go to our next caller.
Thank you, Professor. This is Paul Salamanca at the University of Kentucky. I want to ask you a question about Justice Scalia's decision to join the opinion of the plurality and not to join the concurrence in the judgment of Justice Thomas. His questions from the bench during oral argument certainly suggested to me that he's skeptical that there's any real conceptual distinction between super PAC spending on independent expression and donation. You may recall his reference to drive-by PACs in the oral argument. If he has that level of sort of economic realist skepticism about what's going on out there, why isn't he in Justice Thomas's camp? Do you think he's just waiting for the right moment, or do you think he's had a change of heart?
Well, it's an interesting question. I believe in the past that Scalia has, in fact, suggested he would do away with the contribution expenditure distinction. I don't know what the justices are thinking in this particular case. My gut sense is that Justice Thomas, and I love him to death because I basically agree with his position on this, right? But I think he may have made a tactical error. That is, he's deprived Roberts' opinion of being the majority opinion. And one can envision a case coming down the road soon enough that we might have a change in the court's makeup. I have no doubt, by the way, that the radicals on the other side, and they are radicals, which I think, again, Breyer's dissent in this case was very radical. I think their dissent in Citizens United was very radical, which would have actually suggested that the government could, in fact, ban a book or a movie simply because it was published by a corporation, I thought was quite radical. That group becoming a majority in the future will be able to refer to this as the plurality opinion, and this wasn't really, you know, the majority of the court, and therefore it has less force for precedential value and so on. Now, maybe that doesn't matter because they'd overturn the precedent anyway, even if it had a majority, but I'm not sure that Thomas strengthened the position. Obviously, he's impatient. I think he is correct in his analysis of the confused state of the law and that we would be better, in fact, to just go ahead and do it all. Roberts is a patient, slow-moving man, and I think there's much to be said for the idea of not going further than is necessary to decide a particular case. The challenge to contribution limits entirely was not put directly before the court in this case, and I suspect that Scalia either ultimately simply agreed with that or also perhaps was thinking that, you know, strategically, if this is as far as Roberts and perhaps Alito are ready to go, maybe Kennedy too, then he would join that and give that opinion a bit more force. I mean, I think his views are pretty well known. It would be interesting to see, as I mentioned earlier, I don't think the court is at all pledged to knock down a direct challenge to contribution limits. Obviously, if they really were dying to do it, they could have taken up the Iowa Right to Life case this week and have chosen not to. But we should note that really, I think Thomas, Scalia, and even Kennedy have been fairly clear that they would probably knock that distinction down. People often ask if Kennedy is the swing vote in these cases. I say, no, Kennedy is not the swing vote. You know, he's been on the court nearly 30 years, and he has voted against the government, I think, in every campaign finance case but one, which was a relatively important one where he said, well, our precedent probably dictates this result, but if we had reason to reconsider the precedent, I'd be up for it. So, you know, Kennedy is pretty strong on this, too. And the question is whether Alito and Roberts want to move that quickly. So your guess, Paul, is as good as mine. Ultimately, I've dissembled for a bit, but I think in the end, Thomas wants to hurry the court along, and Scalia was willing to play the Chief's game.
Thanks.
We do have another question now. If you want to have a follow-on question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone.
Yes, hi. This is Justin Myers, formerly with Cause of Action, which you might recognize from our amicus brief was cited by Justice Roberts. So a little plug for my former employer. I have a question. It's a little bit further afield from the topic at hand, but, you know, you're talking about Citizens United, and I remember jokingly saying to people in conversations about that opinion that you know, my copy of the Constitution says Congress shall make no law infringing freedom of speech, and it doesn't seem to have any exception clause that says except in the case of corporations. That won a lot of chuckles from people. But more recently, one of the issues that I hear coming up is about limitations on contributions from foreigners. And I seem to remember some kind of a Federalist Society panel a couple of years ago at their convention. And I'm interested in what you have to say about how this opinion might affect those. I don't see anything in the Constitution that says Congress shall not limit free speech except in the case of foreigners either. So are those limitations, if I understand them correctly, do you think that those contribution limits are themselves up for to be challenged?
Okay, sure. Well, a couple things there, but before I get to your actual final question, I just want to note I do appreciate your comment, Justin, on the, you know, the no exception clause, or as I sometimes have put it recently, and this is actually stealing a line from old Senator Eugene McCarthy, who was a strong foe of campaign finance restrictions, is, you know, the opinion or the position of Sean McCutcheon was, well, we don't remember, you may not remember the first draft of the Declaration of Independence, which said, concluded with the ringing endorsement, and to this end we pledge our lives, our sacred honor, and our fortunes up to $2,600 per candidate with an aggregate cap of $48,600, right? They pledged all of their fortunes, and many of them, in fact, did lose their fortunes in supporting the revolution. Also, you know, when we talk about CU, I just can't resist but point out that this case has been referred to as the next Citizens United, and I sometimes want to say, well, what's so wrong with Citizens United, you know? If we look at what's happened in the 4 years since Citizens United, we've had pretty good electoral competition, we've had good turnouts, we've had incumbents who were subjected to races they would never have been subjected before in the past, which I think is probably good. We had a presidential race where the nomination battles didn't end the day the New Hampshire primary was over, and I don't think that anybody can really find evidence that Citizens United has some way harmed our nation in terms of its overall governance or where we stand, that it has some way damaged things. And this is merely a point off the bigger point that I don't think you can show much success from the regulation that we've tried since 1974 in the arena. Anyway, with that kind of a couple throwaway comments there, let me get to your specific question about foreigners. Now, remember that after Citizens United, the ban on contributions by foreigners was challenged in a case called Blumen versus, I think it was FEC. And in Blumen, the Court of Appeals held that there was not a right of foreigners to contribute, upheld the ban. The Supreme Court summarily affirmed that decision. The opinion in that case, I think, was rather skillfully done, and I think probably correct. I mean, there's a concern about, is it a First Amendment issue? Do foreigners have a right to speak? And of course, certainly we allow foreigners to speak in American politics all the time. And in fact, it's interesting, permanent resident aliens have a right to contribute to campaigns. And generally, they have a right to speak out about issues. We can't imagine a law that would say they can't attend a protest or write a letter to the editor of the paper or something like that. On the other hand, the Court of Appeals, the D.C. Circuit, did find there that there is a sort of different sense of political community that might justify restraints on foreign giving. And one can agree or disagree with that. I think the point is that it was viewed as simply a category of people who were outside of the traditional First Amendment protection there, perhaps because they were not deemed to be part of the political community. They weren't going to vote. One can suggest there's a lot of inconsistencies there and so on, but I think there's a rational distinction that can be made whether or not one agrees with it. And I do think, I mean, if you ask me, just the last case I want to see brought up is a case for foreign contributions. I just see no benefit whatsoever to having that be the next case that reaches the court. And I think that the court has to lead public opinion along and help public opinion realize that, hey, the sky's not falling. I mean, I think one of the reasons there's been a lot of strong rhetoric in response to McCutcheon is that Citizens United itself is taking hold. People realize that their elections have not gone into the wastebasket, that things are not that different. Oh, there's still a lot they don't like about elections. They still have a lot of annoying ads and so on. But by and large, Citizens United has been an important development, but it hasn't been something that's been earth-shatteringly bad. In fact, it's probably been good. And as people get used to that as the new norm, I think the reformers get more and more upset and concerned. But if somebody comes along with a case saying, well, let's get foreigners giving, boy, you're going to create, again, a public backlash. You're going to make people worry about it. We need to keep reminding people that prior to 1974, there were no restrictions on giving by individuals, that freedom works, that we elected, you know, Roosevelt and Truman and Eisenhower and Kennedy, and we seem to think we had a great democracy in those days, and bring the public along. I think that, as I say, that there's at least an argument that can be made for treating contributions by foreigners differently, and whether it's a really sound argument, certainly in terms of developing a strategy for leading the people back to freedom and open political campaigns, that's not a case I'm particularly interested in.
Might have touched a few nerves here. We've got three questions pending, so let's go to our next caller.
Hi, Brad. This is Mike Bays from Holtzman Vogel Josefiak. I wanted to ask you about what do you think are the long-term prospects of the anti-corruption rationale? And what I mean by that is obviously the rationale has been narrowed and it looks an awful lot like bribery now. If the four dissenters truly accept Breyer's view, he doesn't really need the anti-corruption rationale to uphold these laws. And it's really always struck me as more a convenient justification than anything else. And FICA and BICRA were passed primarily to get money out of politics to reduce the role of people with money and, frankly, you know, just to regulate for the sake of regulation. So do you think 20 years from now, 30 years from now, the court will still use the and refer to the anti-corruption rationale?
Well, that's a good question. If we look back, most people, I think, now who look at the history of campaign finance reform and when matters are passed recognize that basically restrictions pass based on political concerns. That is, there are certainly some people who are just anti-corruption, and certainly much of the public views money and politics as corrupting, and they like to hope that maybe this will help without really knowing much about it. But among the activists who promote it, the legislators who vote for it, and so on, there's a growing recognition that while there are some people who are motivated by the purest of beliefs, what really gets these things over the hump is a search for partisan advantage. And in particular, the best time to pass campaign finance reform is when one party is in the majority but sees that it's losing that majority position and thinks that maybe it can retain itself in power by limiting the political speech of their opposition. I just think that is what the facts show on this. Now, when the court first took up the major restraints of 1974 in Buckley v. Valeo in 1976, remember that they heard the case in 1975, about a year after Nixon's resignation. There's still a tremendous sense of corruption had to be addressed, and I think the court feared the idea that they would literally say that, you know, you can't regulate in this area at all. But if you read the Buckley opinion, it's extremely skeptical of campaign finance regulation, and it provides for a very narrow scope of regulation, a narrow scope that in the 40 years since, the reform lobby has been consistently trying to broaden and pretend certain elements of the Buckley opinion don't exist. One of that is by broadening the definition of corruption to go far beyond this narrow quid pro quo corruption that the court talked about in Buckley and that again was emphasized by the court in the McCutcheon decision last week. So I think in that respect, the anti-corruption rationale addresses, at least in some general sense of corruption, what the public is concerned about there. And I think the court way back in Buckley probably felt that it would just be more than the public would tolerate. I mean, the court does have political understandings here to simply strike down the entire act. So they attempted to cabin it off. You're quite right. I mean, Breyer and the dissent see no reason for corruption rationale. They think, again, the majority can limit speech simply because they think it will help them stay in power. They wouldn't put it quite that way. They would say, well, because they thought that led to a better exchange of ideas. But right, no corruption rationale. I think, for what it's worth, that the court is inexorably moving toward a document that, if we don't go in Breyer's direction, we will go in the other direction. That is a doctrine of separation of campaign and state, where we're simply going to say the government cannot regulate political campaigns. The discussion of the people about who they want to rule them. There's something very anti-small r Republican, anti-small d Democratic about putting the government in that position. You know, obviously, in a sense, Thomas is there because if he does away with contribution limits, we're essentially doing away with the regulatory system that is based on the anti-corruption rationale. I think it's quite likely that Scalia and Kennedy are there, and there may even be five votes if the court were pushed to that, and I think that will become the norm. But having said that, it's all speculation at this point. The court also seems fairly content with that basic Buckley precedent, and that precedent does hinge on the idea of preventing corruption.
We've got two questions pending. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone if you have a question. Let's go to our next caller.
Hello, Professor Andrew King, attorney. I had a question for you regarding the foundation for the sort of the separation of state and campaign that you're talking about, do you view it as sort of philosophically rooted in some sort of originalism, or is it a more pragmatic, prudential doctrine born out of experience?
Well, I guess I would say a bit more the latter. It's founded in some sense of originalism in that I don't think that an originalist interpretation of the Constitution would lead one to conclude that there is a power to regulate campaigns. And that's important because much of the justification for government regulation in this area has been found in the time, place, and manner clause for regulating elections. And the court has simply, back in a 1934 case, Burroughs versus United States, simply transferred that over to the campaign period, which in my mind is quite different, that elections are, you know, how you count ballots, how you elect people, what qualifications are needed to vote, registration, and so on. But the campaign is an endless discussion that the American people have, really, and that the government should not be regulating. So I think there's some originalism in that starting point. I think the reason why the court's going to move more and more to the position that you simply need to separate these issues, that the government's scope to regulate is very narrow, is that pragmatism and the reality, the outgrowth. You know, we have now separation of campaigns or of church and state largely is based on, you know, it's not written into the Constitution. It's largely based on the notion that in the end, interpreting the Establishment and Free Exercise Clauses in a way that is meaningful and in a way that has judicially manageable lines requires some kind of separation there. And there are a lot of church and state cases still come up, but those are cases on the fringes. Where do these things blend together? The big issues are pretty much decided. And I think that's what we're going to do largely with campaigns, that we'll find that the big issues are decided. Some of those are decided. We've decided you can't limit newspaper endorsements. I think that's still good, although I'm not sure it would be under Breyer's rationale. We've decided some of those issues very plainly. But I think we'll probably move to the point of simply saying the government cannot attempt to regulate the speech of the people as it relates to determining who they want to govern them in the future. And when we do that, there'll still be some issues on the end. Can you regulate campaigning within 500 feet of the polls on election day? Some things like that at the fringe. But basically, the big issue is going to be that the government will not be allowed to regulate in the area. That's if I'm right, and I think essentially there are going to be two choices, because I think Thomas is basically right in saying the current jurisprudence has an incoherency to it. The choices will be moving something in Breyer's direction that the majority can just kind of do what it wants, or the other will be to say to have a judicially manageable standard that really protects traditional First Amendment values, we're going to have to tell the government you're out. You got to butt out.
Well, just as a quick follow-up, do you foresee there being any sort of reservation or concern based on sort of the case-by-case adjudication that you see in Establishment Clause type cases that the court will shy away from sort of what you're saying because they don't want to get involved in election cases every year, a couple of them every year?
Sure. Well, they're involved in election cases every year as it is. It's hard to find a year now where they haven't had a number of these cases come forward, and I think they would lend a lot of clarity to doing that. You know, one of the things I point out is if we think about, for example, church-state relations, again, we have all these hot cases, and everybody gets very hot and bothered about them, and I'm not trying to suggest they're not important. They are important. You know, I think about them so on, too. And yet, really, you know, we're arguing over things like, can you put a creche up in a particular area? Can you have the Ten Commandments in a courtroom? The big issues are resolved there. We know that the government is not going to directly subsidize churches. We know that the government cannot require churches to put disclaimers on its material that it uses in church. And those issues are totally up for grabs in the political realm. Can the government continue to subsidize political speech favoring certain candidates over others? Can it require you to put various disclaimers on your political beliefs? Those kinds of questions, big questions, are totally up for grabs still in the arena of politics. And I think we're going to find that ultimately we are finding that they're as unmanageable as were church and state until the court took a fairly strong position saying basically the state stays out of the church. out of church affairs. It doesn't subsidize it. It doesn't regulate it. Now, obviously, there's a lot of activity on the margins there, but the big issues have really been decided. And I think the court would find that they'd be in a stronger position to take that approach toward politics as well, that there are, as Thomas says in his concurrence in McCutcheon, there are simply no judicially manageable standards that are at work there. And the Constitution has to mean something stronger if we really believe that political speech is at the core of the First Amendment.
Thank you, Professor.
We have just one question pending. We've got a little time left. If you want to ask a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone.
Yes, my name is Joe Poole from Dripping Springs, Texas. And from a historical perspective, and what makes a lot of sense to me as a voter under our Constitution, or having the right to vote, is that having that right to vote should be exclusive to your speech about your vote. And what I'm suggesting is that we should not have PACs and other groups that don't vote, corporations that don't have the right to vote, making or influencing our political speech. And I know this is a probably a retrograde step, but it makes a lot of sense in that you could give as much money as you wanted to a candidate, but you would be branded with that contribution that you did it, and it would be perfectly noticeable and trackable who's giving what to what candidate and who's influencing our speech, and only ones that have the right to vote are influencing our political speech. Let me know what you think about that in historical context.
Well, Joe, I would disagree, and because I think that, the right to vote and the right to speak are separate things and should be treated as such. People join together in order to accomplish many of their ends. In order to speak out, they join together. And to suggest that, therefore, a group of people should not be able to pool their resources and run an ad would be contrary to that basic speech right. And oddly enough, it would empower only the people with enough money to themselves pay for an advertising campaign. If I'm George Soros, or if I'm Tom Steyer, or if I'm, you know, one of the barons of the right, so to speak, I can go out and I can pay to run some TV ads and I can pay to have a big campaign going on. But if we have a large group of citizens of very ordinary means, none of us can really do much with our $50 or $200 or even $1,000, right? We really can't get much for it. We get a campaign going only by pooling our resources together, maybe working with one of these rich, you know, folks, or maybe just working without them. But that's how we're going to gain influence, is by working in a group. So I think that the approach, it's one that has some obvious attractiveness to many people because I hear it quite a bit. But I think when we really consider it, we recognize that, you know, clearly we have a right to speak. We have a right to join a protest. We have a right to all march up to the Capitol to protest Roe v. Wade, or to protest the war, or to protest whatever we want. And somebody's got to finance that. We've got to pay to finance that kind of speech. We're going to pay to rent a hall, and we may have to pool our money to do that. And in these kinds of things, I don't see where there's any real issue there. Now, to the extent we're talking strictly just about contributions directly to candidate campaigns, I would note that except for PAC contributions, which are pretty limited, we do have that. Unions can't contribute to federal campaigns, corporations can't contribute to federal campaigns, and other groups cannot, except for PACs, which are a limited effort to allow a sort of a group contribution to a candidate. So, I would say that to some extent, if we think about it that way, we already have that. If you're thinking about extending that to the ability of people to speak independently of campaigns, to just speak of a candidate's campaign, to just speak generally over time, I just think that if we really think about it, it's probably not a workable solution, and it's probably one that, again, although it has some intuitive appeal to people, I think really doesn't hold up under a traditional view of the First Amendment. So I'm going to disagree with you on that, and that's my reason for doing so. But thanks for the comment. I appreciate it.
Can I make one follow-up comment?
Fine with me.
And the idea that you are restricting or affecting political speech by the lack of pooling, is where I would differ, because if you have a Soros that is giving a huge contribution to one candidate, that is, you know, perfectly known. It's published. It's branded. His contribution is known by people, and it's discounted by people. Just because Soros gave $1 million to somebody or whatever he did, you know, it would be known, and it would be discounted for what it is and the speech that it was.
Well, that's true, but, you know, that's true of a group, too. I mean, when the NRA gives money, people know that the NRA PAC contributed the funds. When a corporate PAC contributes, people know that the corporate PAC contributed as well, and they usually have some pretty good idea of what that stands for. So I'm not sure that that's a unique advantage to limiting contributions to individuals.
Well, it's the obfuscation of who's giving money to, you know, a candidate. It's the idea that, that this candidate is for lawsuit reform, and in fact, who's giving that money for lawsuit reform? Is it insurance companies? Is it lawyers, plaintiffs' lawyers? You know, who is it? And that's where the obfuscation comes in on not being able to track, you know, who's affecting our political speech.
Well, I'll make a final comment. I was just say that actually you can track that. You can track who gives to a PAC. You can track if the PAC gives to a candidate. You can track a super PAC discloses its donors. So, in fact, that disclosure we basically have. Well, it's not a lot of work, and that's what papers are for.
Yeah.
I mean, most people do not go and look at disclosure evidence, period. They don't go look and see who's spending anything, and in fact they don't really care, but to the extent that people do care, they rely on the press to do that, and it's not a tremendous burden to do so.
Thank you.
That would be my thinking. Thank you.
Let's take a final question here.
Yes, David Emerson, society member here in Berkeley. Is taking a sort of step back the sort of issue of campaign finance in context, I'm sort of curious of your perspective on why lobbying expenses, which are arguably far more pernicious and corruptive than anything having to do with elections, why those have not been as much of a focus and the reasons for that.
Yeah, that's a good question, and always glad to hear from Federalist Society members in Berkeley too. That's a very good question. As I point out, you know, far more is spent lobbying than is spent on campaign contributions, and in the end, you know, I have to think that there's a couple reasons. One is I think the public just doesn't see the lobbying as much, so that doesn't, you know, get their ire up. But I do think the other is ultimately lobbying influences to some extent what people do after they are elected. There's a lot of folks that would like to limit that. They particularly like to limit lobbying by the business community and so on. But for a lot of people, their real goal in campaign finance is to limit who is elected, to try to rig the system so that their views win at that election stage. Because at the lobbying stage, you know, not many people are just going to change and do things they don't believe. They're going to stick and do with what they believe in. And so I think there is an effort to rig the system to get at the to prevent certain types of candidates from winning and to assure that other types of candidates do win. And ultimately, I think that's why there's so much more attention to campaign finance. Again, it's not to say that some people do not have honest, you know, nonpartisan, neutral reasons for believing campaign finance restrictions are a good idea. But as I pointed out at the outset, generally to pass those restrictions, you need support of the cynical insiders who just want to win their campaigns. And there are certainly a lot of people, both inside and outside, who just want to silence their political opponents. And I think that ultimately is why there's so much greater emphasis on campaign finance reform.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Brad Smith. We certainly appreciate your thoughts today and obviously taking a close look at the opinions all around. To our audience, a reminder that tomorrow at 1 p.m. we're going to speak with Annie McCarthy and author Joy Brighton about her new book on Shariaism. But until tomorrow at 1 p.m., we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.